the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells.
Our next guest is Amy Webb. She's a professor of strategic foresight at the NYU Stern School of Business. She's also a quantitative futurist and a best-selling award-winning author. Her latest book is The Big Nine: How the Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Could Warp Humanity. It's really a call to arms about the broken nature of artificial intelligence, and it's the powerful corporations that are turning the human-machine relationship on its head. Amy Webb, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Because I've read about what a quantitative futurist is, I'd love to have you explain that to our listeners.
Yeah, no problem. I realize that I have a bit of a strange-sounding job title, but as a quantitative futurist, my job is to map and measure the impact of emerging tech trends, to calculate the velocity of change, and to develop data-driven scenarios that explain plausible outcomes for all of the change that's happening around us. So contrary to what a lot of people think, futurists do not make predictions. Most of what we do is make connections, and the point of that is to reduce uncertainty as much as we possibly can so that people can make smarter decisions.
Ah, that's fascinating. And in doing so, you need to be not a specialist, but a generalist across many, many different disciplines.
I would say yes and no. So, I'm a social scientist, and my academic background sounds a little strange. I have game theory, economics, political science, and journalism and music, which I know is a little weird. But most of us, have some quantitative capabilities. And then, there are plenty of people who specialize. So there are healthcare futurists. There are people who focus on the environment. But most of us who do this professionally understand that change doesn't come from a single area. So even though we're all pretty focused on tech, technological change intersects with the economy and education and even like infrastructure, which means that you have to get good at spotting signals emanating from many different places at once.
Right.
Amy, the technologies and the possibilities in artificial intelligence are very exciting. And I just got a kick out of this, that when I'm having conversations with people, inevitably it always gets down to, when are the robots coming for my job, and when are they coming to kill me? And it's that's
right,
just
right. When are the robots going to murder me in my sleep? Tell me when on the calendar so I can mark it down.
Yeah, right. I mean, culturally we've scared everybody. The HAL 9000 from 2001, A Space Odyssey. Certainly Skynet from the Terminator, that rattled some cages, and then Dolores from Westworld. I mean, I guess people should be a little concerned if they're caught up in all that cultural stuff, huh?
Yeah, so, I mean, here's what's going on. It's to some extent, as a species, we've really evolved. Humans have gotten a lot done. But we're still somewhat biologically limited, we're biologically limited by the squishy computers inside of our heads, right? So the problem is that our brains are trying to reserve energy, and we're constantly trying to recognize patterns. And the stories that we tell tend to leave lasting images, and the more that we hear similar storylines, the more that they feel like our destiny. And there's like a whole bunch of regions of the brain that get triggered or put to sleep depending on what we're talking about. But to some extent, that's why some of these images from Westworld, for example, or Black Mirror, are so they feel so resonant. Part of it is because we've heard them over and over again, and the more that you hear something, the more that it gets validated. The other reason why is because we do a really bad job of thinking about ourselves in the future, and it's not our fault. There's a part of the brain called the medial prefrontal cortex, which gets fired up when we're thinking about decisions we have to make right now, but it kind of goes to sleep when we're thinking about ourselves in the future. So for all of these reasons, when we're talking about a complex technology and its implications, like AI, it's way easier for us to rely on the patterns that we're familiar with than to investigate things that are new. And to be perfectly honest, AI is kind of boring. Like when you get down to it, we're talking about data and algorithms and systems that make decisions for us. And the nitty-gritty of AI is like, unless you're in the field, it would put most people to sleep. So I think for that reason, we're, most people, when they think about AI, are thinking the wrong things. And that's why we have all of this misplaced optimism and fear.
And what there's a number of things I really enjoy about the book, and one of them is that it's not a usual AI debate. It's a warning. It's a blueprint for a better future. Can you tell us how you have organized your book?
Yeah. So the book is written in three parts. Part one sets up how we got to now. So there's a quick and dirty history that actually goes back a millennia. And what most people don't realize is that AI is not. It feels very modern, and it, you know, we're constantly hearing about it. But in practical terms, AI has been in some form of development now for hundreds of years. So the beginning of the book is all about that and this tension between mind and machine, and trying to create machines in our image that think a lot like us. But in doing that, we have built a relatively small community of people who tend to look and think a lot alike, who share the same worldview, who are responsible for making the choices about AI and how it gets trained and the decisions that are made. And for the most part, they tend to work at, as the title suggests, nine companies. So in the modern era, there are nine companies, six in the United States and three in China, that are building the custom frameworks, the custom silicon. They're making big, important decisions about research. They're funding that research. You know, they have the lion's share of patents. They can attract the top talent. And it's these companies that are really building our destiny, what comes next. The problem is that in the United States, speed is prioritized over safety because we're a free market economy, and there's a huge rush to commercialize AI. And in China, where the other three companies are based, the problem there is that those companies are under the rule and the thumb of the Chinese government, which has its sights set on a new world order, one in which China is at the helm, and AI is a big piece of that. So that's the first part of the book. The second book explores the next 50 years of the development of AI using a tool that's part of every futurist toolkit called a scenario. So I've written three chapters. One's an optimistic one, one is a neutral one, and one is a catastrophic one. And each one of those chapters explores, using data and evidence and models that I built, this is how things could turn out over the next 50 years. And they're written in a narrative format. And the third part of the book is once you are terrified and have a stomach ache after getting to the end of this catastrophic chapter, what do we do to fix the future? And so the third part of the book is all about steps that all of us can take, because all of us are a part of this, to make sure that optimistic scenario is achieved.
If you're just joining us, our guest is NYU Stern professor and founder of the Future Today Institute, Amy Webb. Her new book is The Big Nine: How the Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Could Warp Humanity. Amy is saying warp humanity. Is that optimistic, pragmatic, or catastrophic?
Yeah, I know. It's a salacious sounding word. I think unless serious and sizable steps are taken, which is going to require us making some short-term sacrifices that might be uncomfortable in the name of a better future, then which I think is unlikely unless huge things happen, then I think our future is warped either way. Now, to the degree to which it's warped, I think we still have some control over. But we can see this unfurling already in front of our eyes. I mean, every day there are revelations about new data sets that were compiled, used, and built without people's knowledge. We can see China making inroads into all different places around the world with its technology. Today, it was announced that China and Russia have a new agreement to put Huawei technology into place. You know, it's happening as a sort of explosion in slow motion. You know, and I think we are so accustomed to listening for a big boom that we are missing what's, you know, all of the developments that are happening right in front of us.
Yeah. Something you said a few moments ago about a new world order with China at the helm made me think of sort of a metaphor, Mark Zuckerberg grappling with learning a little Mandarin while Alibaba's founder, Jack Ma, started as an English professor. And so he wows crowds all over the world with his perfect English. I just find that an interesting little ditty. And I wanted to explore a little bit more of these Chinese companies, the big three that you're talking about. Why don't we start with Alibaba?
Sure. I should also mention, I lived in Japan and China for a while, for years. So
right.
I'm familiar with the cultural differences between our countries, but also how that affects business practices. So the three companies in China are collectively known as the BAT, B-A-T, mm-hmm. and they are Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent. If you're not familiar with these companies, don't worry, unless you know how they are not easily accessed outside of China. So Alibaba is sort of akin to, and that's the company that Jack Ma founded, mm-hmm. Is akin to Amazon. So it's an online store, e-commerce giant that, similarly to Amazon, has, you know, sort of a prime day, you know, some shopping days throughout the year where everybody goes online to shop. But the volume and the speed and the revenue just eclipses by orders of magnitude what we see here in the United States.
With Amazon.
So that's Alibaba, and Alibaba also has a payment gateway called Alipay, and many different subsidiaries and investments in different areas. Baidu is akin to Google, so it's a search engine. It even has, similarly to Google, a self-driving autonomous car unit. Tencent is a little different. It's one part esports and gaming. It's also a social network. It's also a payment system. They have a healthcare division. These are three enormous, incredibly important companies that are all NASDAQ listed.
I am... not afraid of AI. I'm kind of excited about it. I mean, there's certainly a lot of work that needs to be done in policy and all of that. But the thing that really concerns me is that, you know, you look at China and they've got all of that long-term planning. They put a stake in the ground and said AI is going to be very important and we're going to be the major league player on the world stage in so many years, if not now. It's so pervasive into all of their different programs. What is it about China? Was it Mao that started this long-term planning, or how did it all? You know, why are we so different?
Mm-hmm. Well, the five-year plan came from Stalin, and had a you know, radical effect in building Russia over and eventually the Soviet Union over a long period of time. Throughout Asia, the five-year planning convention is fairly pervasive, but culturally, there's just a practice of thinking much longer term, inside and outside of business. So that's why you see a bit more dedicated effort and organization around longer-term strategic thinking. That is not the case in a lot of other areas around the world, and especially here in the United States. For some reason, I mean, to some extent, that's because of our, I think, political system. You know, our leaders change hands every couple of years by design. That's how our democracy was founded. But it also makes it really difficult to do long-term planning when you've got potentially, you know, sweeping change every 4 to 8 years. China doesn't have that problem. In fact, they've made the probability of that problem even less because their current leader, Xi Jinping, there was a rules change within the government, and he's now effectively president for life. So that makes it a lot easier to ensure the longevity of long-term plans. Now, China's had plenty of long-term plans and plenty of five-year plans, which have failed to bring forward all that was promised. I think what's different this time around is that there's a strong leadership in place. The leadership of China's government, the CCP, which is the prevailing political party, has great understanding of technology. They are organized, and they have embedded AI into other political initiatives, including the Belt and Road Initiative, which some people listening may have heard of. This is an infrastructure project where China is sort of going along its old Silk Road route and doing economic development in lots of different countries, helping them build out their bridges and their roads in exchange for debt service. But also there's a digital component. So that's where, you know, that's why part of the reason why Huawei is so interesting right now, because in addition to deploying people to build bridges, they're deploying 5G and all of the different telecommunications infrastructure and phones that are made in China and are subject to Chinese oversight and rules, you know, which would scare a lot of us.
Yeah. We definitely want to talk about other members of the Big Nine, but before we do, let's just talk about technology for a minute or so. Google builds AlphaGo, which is a machine that can play humans in the game of Go, and they load it with the outcomes of 100,000 games, so it has this database of all these games that have been run with successful strategies, and it goes ahead and it, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, it beats the number one Go person in the world. And then they design and build something called AlphaGo Zero. They start from scratch. They don't give it any data on games that were done before. It just basically says, here's the parameters of the game. Figure out a way to win it. And in 70 hours, it starts playing. It plays itself for 70 hours, and then it goes out and it can beat anybody. And then it plays itself for a bunch more days, and it goes back to AlphaGo, the original machine, and it beats the daylights out of that every time. So this is the self-learning component, isn't it?
Yeah, so just a couple things to unpack. Part of the development of AI has been in the realm of games. Again, if the prevailing idea is we're trying to teach machines to think and we're using ourselves, or at least what we know about ourselves, as the benchmark, then, you know, since early days here, like the 60s, part of that development track has involved teaching computers to play games against humans and seeing how quickly they can win. So between that and other tests, you've probably heard of the Turing test, which is where,
of course,
this was a paper that was proposed as one way to tell how strong an AI had become. If a person is asking questions to both a computer and another person, and everybody is sort of in a blind room, the person asking those questions can no longer tell the difference where the answers came back from. Was it a computer or a person? Then the sort of test is passed. So most of the tests to determine the strength of an AI have had to do with deception and replication, which is kind of messed up if you think about it, right? And so what started out as checkers, and it took a long time for computers to get good enough at checkers to beat humans, and then chess. The reason that Go, which is if you're outside of Asia, is a game you probably haven't played before. It's a board game that uses white and black pieces. It's a giant grid. And unlike chess, there's no prescribed moves per piece. It's more about placing pieces wherever you want in a goal to gain territory. The reason is they're both perfect deterministic information games. However, it's really hard to tell who's winning a game of Go. Go's like easy to get going at the beginning and then super hard the further on that you go. It's more about intuition versus blunt strategy. And that's why Go has been this sort of high water mark within the AI community for so long. So the fact that somebody built a system that could not only play Go, but could beat you know, the grand champions all around the world became kind of a big deal. The thing that happened after that was that these systems got really good. Learning on their own was another huge big deal. And actually, just a couple months ago, that same system was re-released. It's now Alpha Zero. And rather than only learning how to play Go, it has learned, again, starting from zero, how to play three games simultaneously, which is an example of multitask learning. And I would argue the first, one of the first concrete examples we've seen of artificial general intelligence.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. And it shows your background in gaming, how adept you are at talking on this subject. Amy, I'm wondering, before we let you go, as a sociologist, what advice would you give to the average consumer? You know, we John and I all the time get interview solicitations, people who've written books on, and the basic tenet is, oh, algorithms are controlling our lives. But it would seem to me that, you know, humanity can rise up and the average consumer can have control over how much algorithms and AI are controlling us. What would you say?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the first thing I would say is I don't know that I would call myself a sociologist, but this, because there are plenty of sociologists who do exceptional work that are far outside the realm of what I do. But what I would say is that there is no way to unplug. I think one of the great fallacies is that we think that there is some sort of moment, some event horizon, some singularity, some moment in time when the machines wake up and, you know, chaos ensues. And, you know, we need to stop that narrative. Mm-hmm. There have been for many years various systems making decisions on our behalf in ways that are both significant and invisible to us that have profound implications. So we've been living with AI. We just don't recognize that that's what it is.
Right.
So there is no way to be a modern human, and not in some way be subjected to the decisions that an algorithm has made. There's no way to unplug. So that's not to sound defeatist, but it is a requirement that we shift our thinking a little bit. So the implications are be a lot smarter about the information that you're sharing. If you see an interesting app or something going around on social media, upload a photo, take a picture, and see what you are, right, or what cool art painting you look like, whatever it might be. You know, there's a reason that companies are doing that, and it's to learn from us in real time. Mm. So be somebody who sort of has better digital street smarts. Start thinking about and demanding transparency. And certainly as we're headed into a presidential cycle where privacy and transparency are being talked about a lot, you know, as you go to the polls and you make your decisions, you should make some of those decisions with that in mind. Are all of our future governors and presidents and local officials need to gain competency in technology so they can make smarter decisions? So do people who run businesses and people who teach school. You know, this is everybody. We have to sort of level up our knowledge and our comfort level with tech.
Really good point. You know, a book like yours, I would think, maybe I'll send this to my dad for Father's Day. Ah, no, he's not interested in technology. But really, it is all of our responsibility to be interested, as you're saying.
Yes,
here.
That's right. And I will be perfectly honest. I wrote this book in part for my dad.
Oh, that's...
So my dad
perfect.
Doesn't quite sort of grok what I do for a living,
yeah.
Which is fine. But he's brilliant, and he doesn't understand AI, and he wants to. And I wrote it for him.
Amy, we've got to let you go. Thanks so much for joining us. And that was Amy Webb. Her new book, The Big Nine, How the Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Could Warp Humanity.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute.